Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is Evan Basilik, and I'm here with Sujit DeMello today. We also have our special guest, Connor Kelly. I'm here to talk about some of the cool work that we are doing around solar energy with SSE Airtricity.
One announcement we'd like to make is the new SAP HANA certified memory optimized VMs, which are now available. Back in June, we announced the general availability of several new Azure virtual machines with Intel. These are the new Pentium Xeon Platinum Cascade Lake series of chips, and these had things like deep learning boost technology and hyper-threading technology that were baked in. These are like the DDV4, DDSV4, etc., EDV4 and EDSV4 series. These have now been certified for SAP HANA. And this is the big deal because SAP HANA, as you know, is a monstrous system that requires a lot of resources to be installed in Azure. And these VMs do have all those resources. But it's not just about the actual availability in Azure, the VM availability. There's also a lot of process and architecture and administration that's required when you deploy SAP to Azure. And kind of a side note I'd like to make here is that one of our Microsoft colleagues has written a book on this. His name is Ravi Kashyap, and he's written a book called SAP on Microsoft Azure, which details all the architecture constraints that you have to consider, all the administration, security, backups, basically how you install SAP on Azure successfully and how you keep it running, right? Azure gives you all the VMs and all the infrastructure, but there are still a whole lot of other things that you have to consider when you to get SAP on Azure. And so he's covered all of those things in a book. So we'll put a link both to the announcement as well as to the book along with this episode.
Well, what we'll do at this point is, Connor, if you don't mind sort of introducing yourself and tell us what you do for Microsoft.
Absolutely. My name is Connor Kelly, and I work at Microsoft on our sustainability technology, essentially. You know, we know that there's this huge transformation towards decarbonization of the global economy. And one of the initial starting points for that is around electricity and energy. And that's where I focus. So I work on a team in Azure, which is aiming at accelerating that decarbonization transformation and providing Azure solutions to try and make it as easy as possible for our customers and partners in the energy industry to achieve that decarbonization and to find new opportunities and new business models inside of it.
So this is an interesting combination because, you mentioned that you're actually within the Azure engineering team. We're actually using some of our IoT technology with this, but Azure is actually consuming ultimately the energy that is produced using this to help run our data centers, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very symbiotic relationship for sure. I've been at Microsoft nearly 14 years as a software engineer most of that time. And a lot of the early work that I've done that I had been working on for 7 or 8 years, 9 years, was with colleagues in Microsoft Research and the data center teams as Microsoft started to build out data centers globally, that it was becoming really clear that we would be big electricity consumers with our data centers. And that provided us an opportunity to start working right at the state of the art of research to understand how from the very start we could power those data centers with renewable energy and how, not just that we could buy renewables, but how could we use those renewable energy purchases to push forward the state of the art around decarbonization? How can we drive forward decarbonization of electricity grids? And so, yeah, I've been really lucky to work with colleagues at Microsoft on that. And Microsoft have been really lucky to have really forward thinking partners in the energy industry around the world to work with on it.
So I got to ask, so software developer working with folks that are building the data centers, like it's a little bit off topic, but what does that mean? Like what were you actually developing?
Sure. So what we were developing, just take a step back. We were going to be consuming a lot of electricity and we were building data centers that would do that. And, you know, where do you actually decide to build data centers around the world when you want to offer a cloud product? So what we were actually physically doing was building models of electricity grids around the world to understand how much electricity would cost and how much carbon emissions that electricity would release if we built a data center at any given place in the world. So we built tools that were, you know, a heat map of the whole world by electricity grid. And, you know, there are other factors that are taken into account, like fiber connectivity, distances to other data centers, all sorts of things. But that was one of those things in that heat map, you know, is to understand electricity grids for costs and carbon emissions. And so that's what we were looking at that time. And then when data centers were built, so fast forward 2 or 3 years, and those first few data centers started to be built. And then we were looking at, you know, how do you run them as efficiently as possible? And the first generation of data centers, certainly for Microsoft, were built in very hot areas in the US. And one of the key metrics around data center efficiency, it's called the PUE, power usage effectiveness. And that is the ratio of how much energy or how much electricity that you power just the computation versus how much energy it takes to power all the other stuff in the data center, which is effectively a tax. And that first generation of data centers, about 3 times the amount of power that was consumed just by the computation was consumed in air conditioning. So it was quite a high PUE, so not very efficient. And so a lot of the learning from that first generation went into the much bigger build out of second generation data centers that could do things like free air cooling. So some regions around the world can leverage free air cooling now. So there's no AC at all. And that cut the electricity bill by about 60%. Which is hugely significant for a big building. So that was the kind of next generation of software and data analytics that we had built to try and, you know, learn as much as possible from that first generation and roll it into subsequent patterns. So that's kind of the way that the software and physical hardware data center teams have learned and worked together over the years towards kind of massively increased data center efficiency. And then when we start to talk about the things like distributed solar PPAs, now that's kind of the third generation of learning between the data center teams and the software teams in Azure for how to keep pushing things forward in terms of decarbonization and efficiency.
So I'm curious, what is the PUE of that submarine data center that we had?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's probably quite efficient because it's using, you know, free water cooling from outside. So there's no air conditioning, as I understand it. So probably quite good. And, you know, you can so PUE, as data centers around the world have become way, way more efficient. There's been a bit of a shift away from PUE because it's very, very focused in what it targets. And it doesn't target a few other opportunities for optimization. That we have data centers now that are PUE of 1.1 as opposed to 3 or 4. So it's really just the tiny margins where the savings are coming from right now. And also, it kind of incentivizes you to consume more energy. If you're just focused on the PUE, if you consume more energy somehow in your computation, that improves your PUE without actually improving, say, your environmental impact. So there's been a much bigger focus now on computation, and there's some really, really impressive you know, people at Microsoft that are working on this green software engineering itself. So one of the areas of focus has actually moved away from hardware and energy procurement to simply writing software that it itself is really, really efficient. There's a great website, I think it's the 7 Principles of Sustainable Software Engineering, that's been published by one of our colleagues, Asim, and that's definitely worth a read if you're interested in delving a bit more into how to make software itself efficient before you even think about making the data center that runs that software efficient.
that's cool. I mean, that and this sort of goes back into, you know, the data center work that we do, right, obviously it's about impacting our bottom line to some extent. It's also being a good consumer, or I'm sorry, a good custodian, right, of the environment and the world. But we feed all these designs back into public standards at the end of the day, right? So we're, this isn't, you know, something we're sort of keeping just to Microsoft, right, or whatever. This is sort of out for everybody to leverage and use.
Oh, absolutely. So our aims have always been bigger than just Microsoft. It's been to try and identify projects that would genuinely move the state of the art forward. And not just around decarbonization, but when we think about distributed solar PPAs, like that project announced in Ireland.
So you know, back up just one second, Carter. PPA is what you mentioned earlier, and I forgot to ask.
Power purchase agreement. So
okay, gotcha.
How the world has worked for the last 20 years for renewables from a corporate point of view, a big corporate consumer like Microsoft signs what's called a power purchase agreement with a big constructor of renewable energy. So we'll sign a 20-year power purchase agreement that says we'll buy all of the power this new wind farm generates at 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And so that construction firm can then go to a bank and say, well, we need $100 million to build it, but here's our guaranteed income stream. And that's how you know we're going to repay your loan. And that is at a 10,000 foot how finance works for the construction of new renewable energy. And that's what a PPA or a power purchase agreement is.
Gotcha. Okay. So we basically say, hey, we're going to buy the energy you're producing over time. And that provides them the revenue stream, you know, at that
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
They have to have somewhere exactly. to sell it to, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Yeah. And for the last 5 to 10 years, the real engine room of driving renewable energy procurement globally, or driving that renewable energy build out globally that we've all been impressed with, has been corporate power purchase agreements.
Okay. And I think, sorry, I think I may have sidetracked you. We were talking about that we're pushing these design ideas back into the public domain so that everybody can use those, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess it speaks to some of the other non-decarbonization benefits of this type of distributed PPA or distributed power purchase agreement. So it probably also helps just to give a bit of background on the project itself before delving into the benefits.
Yep.
But so the project that we had in Ireland, it is what's called a distributed power purchase agreement. So I think, as I've mentioned, the last 5 to 10 years have been about the construction of new huge wind farms and solar farms. They're typically built in rural areas, and the power is then transmission infrastructure brings that power to urban areas where most of the electricity consumption is. Where this type of deal differs is that it builds solar on existing rooftops. So this particular deal puts solar on about 30 school rooftops and one hospital building. And our thinking with our partner SSE was, you know, can we rethink power purchase agreements in a way that doesn't compete for land with things like agriculture or wildlife? Can we use existing property? And can we avoid the construction of new transmission infrastructure when we build renewables? So that was the background to this project, where we tried to create an approach that would use existing roof space for us to procure our renewable energy. And, you know, one side benefit of doing that is it distributes sustainable income into the communities surrounding our data centers. And, you know, I think we've all, for the last 10 years, we've seen this kind of slow march of inequality. And I think we would all recognize that that's a problem. And if we can identify ways of undertaking this decarbonization challenge that we have for the global economy, for all of humanity, to avoid runaway climate change, if we can find a template for that in a way that also addresses inequality, well, that's fantastic, right? So that was one of our reasons that we were so passionate about getting this project through, to hold it up as an example and say, look, this is a way that the world can decarbonize, and to do so in a way that delivers sustainable incomes into communities around the world.
Yep. Yeah. Although, you know, this just occurred to me, I'm gonna have to follow up with you after, because I have solar panels on my roof. I'm up for a PPA here, right? I can power one little server somewhere.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just like, this is a gateway to a whole new world of this.
Absolutely.
You know, we've heard it for the last 10 years, democratizing energy, but you know, I really think that this is our first tangible step to actually achieving that. And I would reference another kind of interesting deal that we did last year with another partner in Sweden called Vattenfall. So that deal was around the it was around the signing of a deal that would deliver continuous renewable energy, as opposed to renewable energy just when the wind is blowing for a wind farm or where the sun is shining on a solar farm. So like that has been great for decarbonization. But the problem is you do actually start to plateau around 50 or 60% of electricity that can come from renewables if you don't have any energy. And so that deal with Vattenfall was about thinking, you know, how can we drive that forward? How can we stimulate energy storage into the system? And so we worked with fantastic forward-thinking partners, Vattenfall, around signing a deal where they would continuously supply us with renewable energy at an hourly level, not just when the wind is blowing. And they do that using some Azure tools to monitor the generation from their solar and wind farms, and also monitoring their customers' consumption. And when there's a shortfall of renewables, they dispatch hydro storage to make up the shortfall. And in that way, they can guarantee their customers hour by hour renewable energy, as opposed to monthly or yearly, which is the current state of the art. And you know, where that meets something like the distributed solar PPA in Ireland is that it was quite easy to do an hourly renewable energy product in Sweden because there's lots of hydro storage. So the Swedish geography is very friendly to storing large amounts of energy in water. You know, most of the rest of the world, they don't have that favorable geography. So our belief is that that energy storage will come from distributed energy sources. And that is the electric vehicle parked in your driveway, the solar panels on your roof, and the battery that stores the power from that from those solar panels. And so we think that if we can create those tools and work with partners, that the next generation of hourly renewable energy will use thousands or millions of customers' distributed energy resources to store renewables when they're generating, so they can continue to supply renewables to the grid when they're not generating. And that's where your solar panels and your electric car come in. That this would be, you know, where you would benefit from all of this is, you know, it's a monetization opportunity.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And like, while you're very unlikely to, you know, be up at 3 a.m. out of bed telling your battery to charge and discharge with a button, what is almost definitely going to happen is your electricity supplier would just offer you, you know, $50 check in the post if they can optimize it remotely on your behalf to balance the grid and to satisfy renewable energy storage requirements to continue supplying renewables into the grid. And they would do that using tools like Azure IoT. They would be able to remotely optimize and control huge numbers of distributed energy resources for the benefit of everyone, basically. And the upshot as a customer is that you would get a check in the post for some of the profit made out of that monetization. And you would have the good feeling that your energy sources were being used for the greater good of decarbonization of the grid.
Yeah, this is so clearly I'm doing this all wrong because not only am I not getting paid for my solar panels, but on top of that, like I've got, you know, one of these smart thermostats, and apparently that the company that I buy my thermostat from and my local utility partnered up where there's, I forget what they call it, but you know, basically that it will pre-cool the house when electricity is cheap. And you know, I live in a very hot part of the US, and it'll that way. So we're not consuming the electricity when it's high, but I'll have to go back and double check. I'm pretty sure I'm not getting a check for that. But it sounds like it's the same concept as you're talking about, right? So you have this utility that somebody like Microsoft has this agreement with to purchase their energy, but the utility is actually providing that through this distributed mechanism behind, you know, sort of one layer behind that.
Yeah, exactly.
Connor, what is hydro storage? You mentioned that term. I missed it. What exactly is that?
Sure. If you build a dam on a river, lots of water builds up behind that dam. If you have a turbine in the dam, then you can generate electricity with that water. But crucially, you can decide when you want to let water through the dam. So all of that water backing up behind the dam is a really big battery from the electricity grid's point of view, right? It's just a lot of stored energy using gravity to store electricity that you can generate whenever you want. So that's what I meant by hydro storage.
Awesome. That's really good. So that balances out when the wind or the sun is not available. So you use all those three together, you create some kind of a model, maybe look at weather and climate and other things together and figure out how best to tap on the power resource in each of these areas.
Yep, that's exactly it. And, you know, it's a great metaphor for the way we're seeing, you know, software. So there's two kind of emerging trends that are making all this possible. The first is the cost trajectory of things like solar and wind, as well as battery storage. So they're becoming much, much cheaper. So the physical energy systems are becoming available. And then the other is software, the software to control it all. And you know, I think your point speaks to the second one, the way we're seeing these increasing software opportunities to build these data analytics capabilities to eventually result in the optimization of all of these assets so that they're optimized for, you know, for mutual benefit of everyone around kind of monetization, grid stability and decarbonization.
So are we building any like platform or some kind of for offering to allow other utility companies to do this easily?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have, you know, what we would call accelerator solutions. And, you know, as Microsoft, we're not building end products. It's our customers that ultimately understand their domains, right? But what we do well is two things. One, we can build, you know, really secure, high performant platforms in terms of Azure, so cloud computing platform. And the second thing we do well is software engineering. So we can build these core building blocks that we would call accelerator solutions, and they can just make it really, really quick and easy for our customers to build differentiated products in these domains. So we can do a lot of that software engineering work that just gives them these kind of generic solution accelerator that'll do, say, 90% of the work they would need to build their differentiated products, like the one that Vattenfall has built. This, you know, it's the world's first hourly renewable energy product, and that's built on top of those Azure capabilities. So they were able to bring that to market quite quickly because of those accelerator solutions.
And then these, I'm just kind of hypothesizing here, but these like a combination of like machine learning and IoT, and what are the kind of other, you know, Azure services might have been involved with these with this platform?
Yeah, absolutely. So Azure IoT is a way to talk to a very large number of IoT or Internet of Things devices. So that's the gateway with which all of that data, you know, bidirectional communication comes into the cloud. But, you know, our customers don't just bring in data for the sake of it. You know, clearly they want to do something with it. They want to take some meaningful action based on that data. So we leverage, like, you know, big database platforms like SQL Azure and Azure Cosmos DB. So they would be the major structured and unstructured database offerings to bring in all of that data. And then things like Azure Data Factory is very useful for building pipelines for various stages of processing of the data. So you can make some sense of it, and then you can create forecasts, as you say. So we can build machine learning models from large amounts of data that can very accurately predict what the future, you know, what the future entails. So you can do things like, you know, training models for solar generation on one specific place. If you can have historic solar generation data and historic weather data, well, you can quite accurately learn the relationship between time of day, solar irradiance, and how much solar is going to happen. So then you just need to look at a weather forecast to get a very good solar generation forecast. So those type, that would be just a very simple example of a machine learning model that you could build. And, you know, Azure Data Factory is a good place to do that. Azure Machine Learning is a very useful for drag and drop machine learning model creation. And then we have visualization tools like Power BI, which can, it's just a very low effort visualization creation tool. So you can point that in Azure Cosmos DB that has thousands or millions of entries and very quickly come up with a visualization that allows you to extract meaningful conclusions from the data.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it sounds like this is only going to get bigger over time. So this is awesome. Thank you for the sort of the education on sort of how we're growing this space, how we're leveraging it. Any last thoughts that you want to leave the audience with, Connor?
I think that the this trajectory is clear, right? So we've seen wholesale renewables kind of building to a certain point, and now we're getting to this great stage of software coming together with both large-scale renewables and distributed energy resources to open up all of these new business opportunities. So it's really just to embrace that, start thinking about what novel, if you're in the energy industry, what novel business models can you put together out of these new developments that you could offer to your customers? And, you know, we're here to help you do that in terms of Azure tools. And then the second side is, we focus quite a lot on electricity here, but there's all of, you know, different forms of energy that are emerging. So electricity is responsible for something like 30% of all of energy's emissions. So that means the 70% carbon emissions that are not currently related to electricity. And so there's parallel efforts around things like hydrogen, carbon capture and storage, and energy storage in general. So there's all these other domains of research happening. So they're also really interesting areas for the application of technology to, you know, achieve this decarbonization challenge that we all need to undertake. And, you know, they're also areas that we're here to talk to about, essentially, to provide software capabilities to help accelerate that transformation. So, you know, be thinking about it and think about the tools that you can use to achieve it. And we're here to help with that.
Yeah, that's great. No, thank you very much for coming on and talking about this. We will definitely follow up with you and get some of the links that you referenced so we can put them in the show notes. You know, that the sustainable software one actually sounds really interesting to me. You know, but great. Thank you, Connor, for coming on. Sajid, any last thoughts?
No, great. This is a very, very educational. I've been like, you know, I've learned so much from this. So some of the, I think you very clearly laid out what the relationship is between, you know, cloud computing and sustainable energy. I had never made the connection before, but thanks for doing that for me.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Great. Thanks, folks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.